From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a new textbook aiming to teach American students a more accurate version of Africa and African history. The authors of the textbook argued that history textbooks in American high schools neglect the continent of Africa to a large degree, and not talking about Africa reinforces the notion of Africa as a dark continent. Children, the authors worry, come away with the idea that Africa has not reached the modern era. The textbook includes pictures of high-rise apartment buildings and busy expressways. It's an Africa some American students never see through their school learning. Well, this new book was new at the time it was published. In 1991, the Rochester Times-Union published a story on February 8, 1991, titled A New View of Africa. The focus was on the effort to make sure history classes are not entirely Eurocentric. This effort didn't get very far. Today, activists are calling for American schools to change the Eurocentric approach to history and learning. Local educator Howard Eagle recently told the Democrat and Chronicle that the focus of a Eurocentric history is racist and is at the core of a racist institution that persists in our nation. When I saw the interview with Howard Eagle, I wanted to know, how would history classes change for American high school students if their efforts are successful? What would the teaching emphasize? Well, this hour we've got the chance to discuss it. And here with us is Howard Eagle, a member of the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action, the steering committee there, and of course the Take It Down committee. Howard, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting us.
Also with us is Dr. Jason Willis, Director of African and African American Studies at the Rochester City School District. Dr. Willis, welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
I appreciate you.
Also with us is Minister Clifford Florence, President of the Faith Community Alliance. Minister Florence, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Reverend Judy Davis, member of the steering committee for the Movement for Anti-Racist Ministry and Action. Reverend, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You know, Howard, I reached out to you when I saw the video that you did with the Democrat and Chronicle because I was struck by a number of things. I mean, as I mentioned right at the top of the hour, it was 3 years ago that a student in Texas looked in his textbook and Africans brought to the United States were described as workers during the slave trade. Workers. His family was outraged. His mother was outraged. It became a national story. But she's pointed out in the New York Times, that's hardly alone. So when you said a Eurocentric approach is racist, I thought, well, what would a new construction of history look like? How much thought, how far down the road are we, if we really want to change this, could we change this quickly?
Yeah, you raised a number of interesting questions. That example that you gave is just one little small
sure.
example of millions that occur all the time in terms of reducing, distorting, omitting, ignoring the history, the culture, the achievements of people of color as opposed to European history, culture, achievements, which are glorified and elevated. And so that's part. But this is bigger than curricula. You mentioned that we want to see curricula become more racially balanced, more what people call sometimes rhetorically multicultural. And we need to talk about that. And we do want to see that. But we have to place this all in proper context. To borrow from Dr. Adam Obeski, one of his favorite terms is, we don't get a clear understanding when we have this discussion in a decontextualized fashion. We have to give it context. So the broader context is what we want to see is significant, measurable improvement in public education, urban public education in particular, with our focus, of course, being the Rochester City School District. That's what we want to see. As part of that improvement, we have to deal with the issue of institutional and structural racism. One of the manifestations of that is the way the curricula looks. That's what we're talking about. So that's only one part of a much broader discussion that we need to be having, and it's important. You ask, how far down the road are we? Not very far. If we're going to really move down the road, then we have to have the right discussion or we'll find ourselves going in circles. And I want to make the point, this is not a new discussion. I'll give you a couple examples and I'll stop. This is from a professor. He was an assistant professor in the Department of Learning and Instruction at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And his interests are intersection of curricula, policy, and classroom practice, writing in the mid-1990s. Here's a quote from a report that he wrote. His report begins, in the late 1980s, New York State Education Commissioner Thomas Sobel, many of us remember Dr. Sobel, created a task force to review the existing state social studies curricula. The attendant report, titled A Curriculum of Inclusion, came under attack from Diane Ravitch, a woman who's today considered to be one of the most progressive educators in the nation and so forth. But it came under attack from her and Arthur Schlesinger Jr. For example, they wrote a scathing critique of the Committee of Scholars in Defense of History. Among other things, they accused the task force of contemptuously, this is a quote, dismissing the Western tradition and contributing to the reduction of history to ethnic cheerleading, casting the task force report as extremist. Multiculturalism was the opening shot in the battle over the New York State social studies curricula. Another example is the Amistad committee that was put together via legislation from the New York State legislation. This is a report from the New York Times, February 11, 2009, and the report begins, 4 years after a history panel's birth, its work is still deferred. Nearly 4 years after New York State passed a law creating a commission to promote the teaching of Black history in public schools, the commission has never met, and five of its 19 seats have yet to be filled. For many educators and parents, the Amistad Commission, named after a slave ship seized by its captors, has become a modern-day symbol of bureaucratic inertia. Nothing has happened. When you ask educators today about the Amistad report, they don't know what you're talking about. We're not talking about free services. They spent millions of dollars on this stuff. It produced nothing. So I'm making a point, this is not a new discussion. It's a very old discussion. We haven't moved. So hopefully part of what we're going to talk about is, how do we move? How do we stop going in circles and pretending that we really want, you know, a truly multicultural curriculum and so forth, and actually move toward that? And I will do what you asked if we have time. I know I'm talking a lot, but if we have time, I'll give you a symbolic representation of what a truly multicultural curriculum would look like. If we have time.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Okay, well, those are some interesting opening remarks there. And Dr. Willis, I think it's important to ask you, given that you've been on the job for just a few months now in the Rochester City School District, to let our listeners know what the mission of your work for the district will be. And then I think it's important to know if you agree with Mr. Eagle's construction of history teaching in this country to begin with as having racist and continuing racist roots.
So the first thing I'll do is start with the latter, not the former.
Okay.
Absolutely, and no question. I mean, that's well documented. There's an absence of that letter of work, not only at the local level, but nationally. It's devoid specifically in those communities of the urban motif. And so how it is that we begin to talk and influence structured learning opportunities for our young folks is something that we're passionate about as a community, and it's something that's not reflected in terms of culturally responsive, not only pedagogy, but specifically curriculum in the classroom. I think it's important to note that Rochester is in a window of beginning to think about and be proactive about doing things differently, right? And so, one, the hiring of my position is a bold move by the district. We recognize the position had been dormant. My first charge is to make sure that I am responsible for the 2019-2020 curriculum. So as Mr. Eagle extended, I reviewed a lot of the work from the Amistad Commission. It has not been used as a curriculum driver. It has been used as a la carte. So it's discretion-based. And when we know it's discretion-based, we know it's not going to receive the right level of intensities that can be scaled out to meet the needs of our kids. Additionally, we have a K-2 curriculum that the Rochester Teacher Center does have and is rolling out in many of our K-2 programs throughout the district. It is a completely culturally responsive framework whereby Dr. Malefi Asante of Temple, which is a critical friend of the district, has also been a liaison to that curriculum and to the work of the Rochester Teacher Center. So we're really concerned about, and the superintendent has been concerned about, what is it that we can put in the hands of parents and families and teachers that are going to have very pragmatic and measurable evaluative changes when it comes to not only outcome-based measure, but very truly and honestly, based on the trauma, social and emotional wellness for our children, right? And so those are the things that we're concrete about now. And we also have a framework by which we are going to scale it out and make sure that it reaches all levels in the coming years.
I know that the minister and Reverend want to jump in, and I don't want to dominate, but I have to respond to a couple of those points, because we need to really parse out these various issues and be very clear about what's happening. As it relates to beginning to think about, that's wrong. We've been thinking about this. We've been through this over and over and over again. None of it is new. None of this is new. You can go back and check. The district has had so many initiatives where we start down the road and they dead end and never result in anything. That's one of the things we need to acknowledge. That's what I'm talking about in terms of
I don't hear any disagreement from
no,
Dr.
No,
Rose.
No. He said we're beginning to think about these things and so forth. No, we're not. We're continuing to talk about these things. That's what we're doing. This is not about disagreeing with Dr. Willis. This is about being clear about what we're doing and what we have done so that we don't keep repeating it. Also, the hiring of his position, he says, is a step. This position is at least 10 years old or older. And let me tell you where it started. Van White, the president of the school board, would not deny this. If he did, I would be forced to call him a liar to his face. The concept of an African-American studies, and we didn't call it department. We said it wasn't about curricula. It was about a department of African-American affairs. We wanted to deal with larger issues in addition to curricula. And I'm not boasting, but it started right here in this head. It started in my head. We took it, myself and one of our colleagues, Wallace Smith, we took the concept to Van White and introduced it to him. And he, for lack of a better way of putting it, I have to be honest, he bastardized the concept and made it about curricula. That's not what it was about. And really, the department, as it has existed, I don't know if it's changing, has been a joke. But how do you have a department with one person, a director, and a half a secretary, the director sharing somebody else's secretary, and no more employees? What kind of department is that? No other department exists like that anywhere, even in the Rochester City School District, as crazy as some things are in this district. It doesn't have a department that has one employee. So that history is important. K-2 curricula has been written, go look, you don't take my word for it, has been written in this district at least several times. And it hasn't been used. Teachers don't have to use it. When I was in the district, the 23 years I worked in the district, I participated in writing curricula, right? But it never was used. It was just put on the shelf somewhere. And educators don't have to use it. All they have to use is what the state sends down.
I want to make sure I understand what I'm hearing, though. Isn't that part of what Dr. Willis is saying? That if you go back to Amistad, if it's treated a la carte and discretionary, you know what happens. If you look at something more holistically, you've got a better chance at making wholesale changes, don't you?
We agree with that completely. But it is treated a la carte still. Okay. That's the point. It still is. That's not what the K-2 curriculum that he's talking about is being written locally. It's not being sent down, imposed from the state level. Therefore, teachers don't have to use it. They do not have to use it.
All right, Dr. Willis, do you want to respond? Go ahead.
So one, there's a lot of merit to what Howard's saying. I mean, we know that there's state mandates and what it is that we operationalize at a local level may not be something that the state is willing to take on, but that's a job of not only Rochester City School District, but our community at large to say that we are concerned about how it is that our instruction, our curriculum is being reflected for our young folks. So that's a state issue, and we have protocols by which to follow in order to be able to get there. I think it's important that we really try to figure out what's going to work in our kids' classrooms now, right? So in full disclosure, you know, being hired May 29th, there is a part-time, half-time clerical position involved, and I'm also in the process of hiring an assistant director. And so we're trying to make those pragmatic steps to make sure that we build out the department and that it's supported in the right way. Some of that takes a little bit of time, but by the time school starts this fall, we will be up and running in the capacity at about 2.5 staff for the department. So, you know, outside of that, you know, Rochester does have a history and is very well noted. Right. And I think that the one thing that we appreciate as a community from Mr. Eagle's perspective is that we're not running away from it. We're running to it. Right. And in that very same vein and in that very same passion, I, too, echo that sentiment. You know, if we're not in as a district and doing it and making sure that we are concerned about and provide actionable items for those platforms that we know are going to help our kid, not only culturally responsive work, not only work around how it is that we provide professional developments, et cetera, then we're missing how it is that we can access and be and affect measures of quality control.
All right, so let's have a conversation, because there's at least a significant amount of agreement from Dr. Willis from the district perspective, from what Mr. Eagle is raising in terms of, do we have a racist framework in historical practice and in history education in the American classroom? A Eurocentric approach. If we're going to change that, Number one, how do you change it? Number two, what does it look like? So let's ask Minister Florence and Reverend Davis want to weigh in on what you've been hearing. I'll start with you, Judy. What do you make of the current debate about how difficult it would be to make changes? Howard is saying we've been having these conversations for decades. They haven't produced much. How do you view it?
I agree that it's difficult through all these decades trying to do this to make those changes if we don't take that first step. And the first step is to understand that history is not this objective thing that exists outside of politics. It sits outside of economics and the cultural situation. And so there's one author that uplifts that one problem in our nation is that we tell history secondly. And what they mean by that is all of a sudden indigenous peoples are quote-unquote, attacking colonists. All of a sudden, African-Americans are having uprisings in various cities across the nation. So the story's told secondly about it appears unjustified that these people of color are taking these actions. We have to be able to start to tell the story firstly and understand how the colonists took over when they came into the New World. We have to understand how the persons in Missouri, for example, for Mike Brown, the educational system there was on probation for 12, 15 years. Even before we get to the Michael Brown incident, there was poor housing, the poor employment. So we have to add back to the story what the dominant culture has set up through policies, practices, and procedures that persons are now have suffered through for decades, and they're uprising to say, we're not going to take this anymore. We want employment like you. We want nice housing like you. We want our children educated properly like you. But if we continue to act like the way that we tell the narrative in our textbooks and our stories, et cetera, that we're telling this story, firstly, we certainly are not. We have not told the whole story of all of the policy, practices, and procedures that have been put into place to destroy housing for us, education, employment, et cetera. I even wanted to uplift one thing. I was reading Justin Murphy's article, and at the end, it uplifted Austin Stewart and a statement that Austin Stewart made when he was trying to offer education to the community at that time. We're talking about the mid-1800s, et cetera. And when you read the statement that Justin Murphy outlined, I'm assuming it was verbatim, I don't believe it said anything about children having or the families having a lack of interest in education. It did say in the beginning that due to a strong prejudice, blah, blah, blah. And so even today, we have in our heads this thought that the Black community devalues education, devalues work, doesn't have a family. So when you have that, even now you're telling stories from a perspective that subconsciously you don't even realize you have. Because Austin Stewart said nothing about not interest. It said that their courage and their ambition had been demoralized because of the strong prejudice that was taking place at that time. So to call that a lack of interest in that article doesn't make sense. It doesn't jibe. It doesn't go with the statement. But even Justin Murphy read what Austin Stewart wrote secondly. He didn't read the first part that outlined this demoralization of our courage and in our ambition to get education is because what has been put in our way. You have to understand the laws that were operating at that time. It was illegal to read and write. You couldn't have a job that involved reading and writing. You could be have lashes on your back for reading or writing. So that's not a lack of interest. That's a strong prejudice in place. There's something that's happening firstly that's causing the demoralization and courage and ambition at that time to pursue an education.
Okay. Minister Florence?
I want to say a couple of things. One is I would challenge the press to go over to the warehouse at the Rochester City School District and see the tons of African-American curriculum that hasn't even come out of the box. And I'm saying curriculum that's been written over 10, 15 years by various personnel. Even when it's used a la carte, the cart didn't get under one box to get to a school. And when we talk about our intent for trying to go in a different direction with this than explain the billions of dollars, the billions of tax dollars that went into textbooks that have not reached one of the 52 schools over this 10 or 15 year period. Those books are still there, and they're probably over at the teacher center. They're probably over some at the central office, some at the warehouse. So when we talk about what our intentions are with this material, it's not truthful, because these textbooks have never been used. Some of the authors of the books know that the material is there. They haven't pushed for it to be used. That's one problem. Secondly, when you look at the performance, particularly of black males, black students in general, and if we're talking about the value of curriculum, you're using predominantly Eurocentric curricula. It's one of the reasons why our children are failing, because they don't see themselves in the curriculum. So therefore, what do you see? You see white students who continue to achieve in the schools that are failing us. They're still going to the schools of choice with or without African-American information. But there's something in the curricula that stimulates them to see themselves achieving and being successful without hearing a first, second, or third story. And then lastly, we're still last in the state. So when you think about what hasn't worked, this should motivate our board, it should motivate our staff, it should motivate our community, that there should be an outcry, that there be an overhauling of all the material, everything. Because now if we continue to have the discussion and, as was stated, no actions taken. And I don't want to just sound like I'm in church, but it's the truth. You know, faith without action is dead by itself. And this community has been dead on arrival when it comes to taking action to that which is wrong. It's wrong what's going on in this community against our students, and particularly brown people, black people, Native Americans, refugees, immigrants, and whatever unfair titles that we want to give people of culture. But that has to end, and we have to take action for these and all people as aggressively as we're doing it for white students, because there are no white people in the county, city, or state that are concerned about their kids failing, because they're achieving everything they need to achieve. But those poor kids, who are they? There are children who are continually be marginalized by epistemic injustice, pushed to the side, and then now we have a system that's built on poverty, failure. Why couldn't it be the other way around, where we get money based on all students achieving and not just some?
And can I just tap into one thing that he said? He said the curriculum doesn't reflect our students of color. In addition to that, it reflects people of color in the way the dominant culture wants us to see ourselves. And that's the power of being the dominant culture and having the power of narrative. And I like to use the word cap, that you can use a narrative to put a cap on an entire people group. And what I mean by those three words is the way that I tell the story, since I'm in dominance, I can tell the story and I can tell people what your character is. You devalue education, you devalue family, et cetera, et cetera. I can devalue your ability. I can show that you haven't done anything, you haven't contributed anything to society. And I can say there's, when you look at these people, there's no innovation. There's nothing here. There's no potential. So if there's a whole entire people group who are lazy, ne'er-do-wells, et cetera, there's no ability here, there's no potential here, then what's the worth and value to them, to society? So if I keep that story, that narrative, that understanding ongoing, then why did they deserve the same things that all other citizens have? That's the importance of being able to control the story.
Can I ask Dr. Willis, is it accurate that there are textbooks sitting in a warehouse that have never been used?
So, really good question. So I can do the second layer of dive on that and actually go over there and find out what textbooks and how many textbooks, and I can turnkey that information back to the community, right? I believe that there are a cache of and a cadre of textbooks for anything that's been in from a curriculum standpoint in Rochester City School District.
They are, unless okay. things have changed, they absolutely are there. I've seen them with my own eyes. They are in the warehouse on Hudson Avenue. When I was teaching in the city school district, while teachers were sitting around in their classrooms waiting for maintenance or whoever delivered textbooks, I would go there and get mine. They were there. And maybe they're not now, but they were. Dr. Willis has mentioned a couple of things that's important. As much as I love the great father of Afrocentricity, Dr. Malepi Asante, some of this stuff begins to look like hustling, because Dr. Asante worked in the district in the 80s. He helped produce a textbook that the district was supposed to use. The minister says some of them are in the warehouse, some are in classroom, some are in garbage cans. Some are at my house because I took them out the garbage can. I took them out the dumpster. So this stuff has been done. It absolutely has. I'm not making it up. Go ask the superintendent and others. They have all the records. None of it is new. In terms of the discussion about devaluing, that is so critical. We need to understand how it plays out. So you get people, even educators, teachers, asking, looking at our children and saying, what's wrong with them? Wrong question. What happened to them? You talk about black people and education in this nation, it's one of the great untold historical feats of this nation. That is how fast African people became educated after slavery ended. How fast black people produced their own institutions after slavery ended. Go look at the statistics. They're there, going from almost 100% illiteracy to leaps and bounds, thousands of people becoming literate in a relatively short period of time. And it becomes truly amazing when you place it in the historical context that Reverend Davis was talking about. It's amazing. It's something. It's an untold story. It still hasn't been told. In terms of curricula, we need to have the discussion about curricula. Again, we got to put it in the broader context. Immediately, our focus goes to history, as it should, right? As it should. But what about the rest of curricula? Tell me why thousands and thousands of young people can't read, can't write, can't do math at or above grade level. Tell me why they're arriving in middle school and high school with third and fourth grade reading levels. And that's curricula too, right? But the broader context is pedagogy, the art and science of effective instruction. So one, I think it was, I don't know if it was the minister or a reverend, mentioned you can't have the discussion in a detached way. That you detach curricula from the act of what has to be done with it. So this is the discussion that we have to have. You asked the question. I hope maybe we can use the rest of the time we have to talk about then what is the solution? What do we need to do? That's what we need to be focused on.
Well, I'll start with Dr. Willis there, and we'll ask all of our guests that question then. What if there's at least an agreement that change has to happen? Dr. Willis, I guess, I'll start with you, is can we get beyond, and do you have sort of the authority, and I don't know the answer to this, to help the district get beyond an a la carte discretionary view of, well, we will teach this aspect of either a book or a recommended approach to history, but not this, or are we going to see a movement to wholesale change, and what would that look like?
So I'd like to think that our city school district is a petri dish of our community at large, right? And so if our community continues to call on and we continue to find value in making sure that we do things a different way, that should be the fodder that we need in order to really make sure that the inertia is moving downhill in the way in which, with the intensities in which it needs to, right? Currently, based on outcome-based measures and simply based on empirical evidence, we can see from a very finite standpoint that we are not yielding the type of product in young folks relative to learning and scaffolding the learning, right, relative to base state assessments and many of the other outcome-based measures. Part of that is the curriculum piece, right? Obviously, our young folks are having trouble with identity, so their lens is skewed. They don't see themselves in the context of the larger population. Being able to highlight that for them is really important. I think there's two things that are really great for us right now. I think that there's two things that really underscore why it is that the window is different for us right now and why we have the potential to really begin to shake the tree and make things happen. Number one is, as an educator, we have the science of the brain of a child, which has really moved exponentially in the last 10 years. We understand the paradigms for learning up and through age 7. We recognize the miracles behind the cognitions and the ability for young folks to really learn in capacities in which we previously only either thought they did or found ways to stifle. Our young folks, now that they have skills and abilities, whereby they can use the internet, are in a situation where they can't make excuses because they can Google search the information, right? We have to provide the motivation for them, the opportunities, the exposure, the influence to begin to allow them to do the things that many of our ancestors did before us, right? They watched how patterns of how things were done, and they themselves became the conduit of how it is to be focused on the actionable items. The one thing that we're sure about is that we need action. Right? We can't just keep talking and pontificating. We need to make sure that we have things and resources in the hands of teachers that is responsive and responsible. We need to make sure that it's done in a way in which not only frames the discussion of curriculum, but also frames the context of who our students are in Rochester. Rochester has a very, very, very unique path on the migration from the South to the North. It's littered with positive, wonderful, bright, affluent history that we as a community are continuously trying to turn over so that the larger population or Rochester and its accompanying districts in the suburb really gravitate towards the amount of pressure that they should be putting on, not just pressure to do better, right, but pressure in terms of support. Are you reading to young folks at the Boys and Girls Club? Are you coming in from your affluent setting and doing something and being able to contribute in a way in which allows you to feel safe but also fosters some type of learning opportunity in kids? And the moment we hit the critical threshold as a community will be the moment that our schools really begin to make exponential gains. And I think that that window is now for those same aforementioned reasons.
Who's going to resist, Dr. Willis? Who's going to resist changes? I mean, typically the people in power resist change that affects them holding power. And just observationally, you know, that's generally in this country. I'm just trying to be as fact-based as I can.
Sure.
It's white people. It's white men. And let me also read another place of possible resistance, and that might be history teachers themselves. And I'm going to read from the Atlantic Monthly. Quote, compared to their counterparts in other subjects, and by the way, let me stop and say to teachers listening, and I know a lot of teachers have been listening to the program this summer, this is not to denigrate teachers at all. This, I'm just trying to observe what we know. Quote from The Atlantic, compared to their counterparts in other subjects, high school history teachers are, at least in terms of academic credentials, among the least qualified. A report by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences on public high school educators in 11 subjects found that in the 2011 and 12 school year, more than a third, 34%, of those teaching history classes as a primary assignment had neither majored nor been certified in the subject. Only about a fourth of them had both credentials. Now, at least half of the teachers in each of the other 10 categories had both majored and been certified in their assigned subjects. So it's a pretty big gap. History comes in last in terms of if my son's in high school, his history teacher is not likely to have majored or been certified in it. So when we go to history teachers and say, we've been doing this wrong, they don't really have a whole, and again, I'm speaking generally. I don't mean to denigrate individuals. I know there's wonderful teachers individually and place to place, but that could be an uphill climb for teachers who are largely white and largely uncertified. Is that a problem?
It's certainly a situation if the data, and I don't have that data in front of me, if the data that you're reading is accurate, that creates a system of kind of internal and external warnings, right? I think it's important kind of from executive level administration lens that we have individuals that are school building leaders. That is their charge and their responsibility to then be able to make sure that they put pressure on their staff in those ways. We also recognize that many of those school building leaders are not from within the diaspora of our young folks that they teach, though some are, right? And so there may be some pushback there. The one thing that we need to be sure about is that when we receive pushback, there's two things that surface, right? Student first. If you're not talking student first out of your mouth, clearly we might not be on the same page, right? And then what is it that is being done from an actional standpoint, not a pontification? How is it that we're setting a framework to do the work and not just talk about do the work?
Okay. Is there resistance? No. Will there be resistance? Yes. Where will it come? There is resistance. There always has been resistance. Yes, it's coming from predominantly white, suburbanite, educators who were educated by the same racist school system that we're trying to impact now. And their perspective is that really many of them, and I don't, like you say, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but this is widespread. For many of them, the problem is not the system. The problem is the children. The problem is the parents. The problem is everything else except them and the system. So we need to really, and I always give you credit for having a son to have this discussion, but we need hours. We got to really get to the bottom. We got to cut through all of the rhetoric, man. Like, we could talk about brain research and cognition, but we have to ask, what does that all mean? We could talk about our students can Google, and I'm with that. I know the idea is they need to know how to learn as opposed to us spoon-feeding them what to learn. They need to know how to learn, right? But when you can't read, what good is Google to you? So the fundamentals. We haven't even talked about the fundamentals. Right, and that's part of what we have to get at. Listen though, look. Every time I hear about the community, in addition to us who work our fingers to the bones in the community, I think about people like Avery Blackman, who makes the case that we don't even have a community. We're so disorganized, so disoriented, so under-resourced, and we don't even have a community. So we got to stop with that abstraction about what the community is doing. There's a relatively small group of us who are doing this work. It's not the masses. And this is not to indict or condemn anybody, but it's to say, what is the reality? We got to be grounded in reality. So we need to organize our community. But the critical missing link is leadership.
That's right.
It's leadership. That's the thing. Where do we start? We begin with people who say that they have the credentials, they have the knowledge, they have the interest, they have the commitment to lead. And it's actually, there's an opportunity in the school district right now. The work that we're all a part of, each one of us sitting here are part of the real initiative, the so-called Racial Equity Advocacy Leadership Team. That holds real promise. But there is already resistance. There's resistance to that work, and it's coming from the union. Nobody else wants to say it, but I'll say it. It's coming from Dr. Urbanski in particular, and many of his blind followers who are in lockstep with him. Again, not everybody, but large numbers, large percentages. Everybody knows it, but people don't want to talk about it. We got to get at that. We invited Dr. Urbanski to come to that table. We did. Our coalition, as soon as we got there and didn't see union leaders, we said they all need to be here. They need to be invited.
That's right.
And they were invited, and then he came once and he left. But the work is promising. It really is promising, what we're doing. But we need to step it up.
And he left the table. He left the table over the critical question about not how white teachers are being represented, but how black teachers and his representation of them and teachers of culture, because they wouldn't have any problems with anti-racist education. But the perspective was only from the 3,000 plus white teachers. But he said nothing about black membership, Hispanic membership, Native American, Asian. What opposition would they have to discuss it? And he stormed out, never to come back, and the other unions that were present didn't come back. And so when you talk about putting children first, as Doctor talked about, how long has Dr. Urbanski been here? And we're not making progress. And part of it is because of the lack of movement on his part to lead the union in the direction that the community wants to go. And I want to say something to encourage the community. Rochester doesn't need to continue to be any different than our wonderful towns around us. White parents have to say one time to any power structure what they want for their children.
That's right.
Doesn't matter what your title is, many of them carry them. But when it comes to their children and they want something for their children, it's done. One statement, one meeting. In the city, we're groveling to people to get them to do. We have over $1 billion, and we're groveling about what we should want for our children. And we in this community have to stand up and do what we must to take over this district and demand, fight, and get what it is that we deserve for our children, as well as what happens in our towns and in our rural areas. If that doesn't begin to happen, we're going to continue to have this conversation just like we're having about poverty. First of all, it was 5 years. No, it was 10 years. No, now it's 15 years. No, it's 30 years. So most of us would be dead and gone and went up to see Jesus. We'll still be having this conversation. That's what we need to bring to an end. What is going to be the first action item based on solution that we as a community are going to rally to? You talk about resistance. You haven't had in the last 15 or 20 years the real 100 people who pretty much run this town come together in one room and one table and say, this is what we're going to do. Until you have that, that's the resistance. Some of them are known, some of them are unknown. But the fact of the matter is, they have not, don't seem like they want to come to the table, and therefore that's why we're floundering, because you have to have power brokers, decision makers in this community to come. If you make your living here and take it out to the suburbs, but yet you're going to condemn what's not happening here, we got to bring the power brokers to the table. And it's not only, you know, white men, but it's also, excuse me, it's also some black men that made it out of the hood with Pookie and them. And now they're in worse shape than the white men who are influencing all the decisions in the wrong direction. So we need to bring a balance to the conversation. And we have to make sure that every group is represented. Because you can't continue to have power meetings with all white males. You got to have everybody who can make a decision to make this community a better place. No longer can we accept that. But yet, that's the reality of what we predominantly do here in Rochester, and it's not working.
We've got about 10 minutes left here. Reverend, I know you want to add to that. We'll do that in just a second. I just want to let our listeners know. I've got about 10 minutes left. I think Howard's point earlier, we should make sure we hit here. How do we move? Well, that's what we're talking about right now and why movement has been difficult. But we'll explore a little bit more. How do we move if we're going to move on this? And also what these kind of changes would in practice look like, feel like, sound like in our classrooms. Reverend, you want to add to what you've been hearing? Go ahead.
Yes. I guess I'm the one at the table. I think that comes from a position of I was just an ordinary person in the community that wanted to help. Facing Race, Embracing Equity was the first initiative said, we're here, we want to address racism in education, healthcare, et cetera. And I showed up for education. I have to tell you that all the tables I've been at for all the initiatives that have sprung up since that time, it comes down to this. Who is going to be more important, students or sensibilities? And I'm talking about white sensibilities. That's my take as an ordinary person from the community, answered the call to come in to help, and cannot believe how much I have learned, what's criminal that's happening in the district. I just can't believe all that I've learned. And at these tables, I'm saying it comes down to, is it going to be the students first? Is it going to be people of color first? Or is it going to be white sensibilities? And that's what it keeps on coming down to. And that's one of the reasons I'm running for the Rochester City School Board this year. Hope I can get some votes out there as you're listening. But again, one of my platforms is equity in curriculum, equity in staffing, equity in funding, timely completion of IEPs, common courtesy to parents. These are all the ways that racism is showing up in the Rochester City School District. I've been at these tables, and just like Minister Florin talked about, the power brokers are there, and who gets the deference is not the student, it's the white sensibilities.
All right, so, and by the way, I should say with about Reverend Davis, she is running for school board. Some of the other candidates have been on this program in recent weeks in different contexts, just as Judy is here today, not in the context of the school board race, but we are going to bring the candidates together, I hope, on this program. Oh, so I'll see you back here.
Sure.
Just to address that race specifically.
Yeah. So sort of nobody says it's unfair. I certainly have heard Melanie here. I've heard LeBron here. Just sort of nobody
Beatrice
says,
LeBron, ooh, Melanie Francis. Of course. No, absolutely. But we will in a different context, bring them together.
If I may just dovetail
please do, Dr.
Off,
Wills, yeah.
off what it is that Reverend was talking about. Yes, absolutely, right? She's talking about lens. the lens, and she's also talking about relationships. And that's the thing that's been damaged over time and space here in the city of Rochester. The relationship between our community at large, our relationship between our community, specifically our communities of color and our indigenous communities, right? We need to make sure that we are providing the opportunities with love and consistency while also being fair relative to issues of race and equity to have these discussions and to build these relationships so that it's not this red tape of what happened in the past, but it's I have a relationship with Reverend. Reverend, I need something done, and you know that my heart is aligned, and we are aligned in a manner in which is student first, right?
Do you agree with her that there's essentially white fragility that's protecting
that,
some
that's what
some,
I meant. I didn't mean what he just said. I didn't mean anything.
Well, that's what I'm hearing from you. Is that right?
I'm talking about white fragility.
Okay, do you agree with that?
Fragility nationally. These concepts that we're talking about aren't just germane to Rochester City School District. These are in communities that suffer, and our community is indicative of a petri dish of a community that suffers. Per capita, we suffer and have suffered historically in some of the most disparate categories, specifically relative to our young people of color. If we can't be transparent about the process of where it is we came, then we're doing ourselves a discouragement. I mean, we're doing ourselves a disservice as we begin to project forward what will be done, right? Because we're not being honest with what happened in the past.
So national context and certainly historical context is important, but you can't use that to shift local focus. The work that we have to do is here. We have to do the work where it is. If anything, we ought to strive to be a model for the nation. But the work has to be done locally. The historical perspective is critical in terms of understanding what the heck we're doing. But we can't begin to conflate and convolute what's happening nationally as an excuse not to do the work that we need to do locally. So that's important.
Can I clarify my statement? Just one thing.
Yeah.
I can say it really quickly. This is from Dr. Carol Anderson. The problem that I'm talking about and highlighting is not that blackness shows up. Is that blackness shows up with ambition, with hope, with innovation, and wants to live like other people, wants a home like other people, wants education, wants employment, wants equity in this nation. When blackness with ambition and aspiration shows up, policies, practices, and procedures also show up to make sure that doesn't happen. That's the white sensibilities I'm talking about at the table.
But let's make it real, right? The white fragility that we're talking about is in Dr. Urbanski's statement when he tells Minister Florence and the rest of us, we can't use the language anti-racist because that's going to offend teachers. And he says it as if he's speaking for all teachers, and then the minister says, well, what about black and brown teachers? I'm sure they won't be offended by that language. And then Urbanski has a conniption because he hasn't even thought about that. But what becomes clear, he's not representing them. He's representing the white majority, and he's not wrong. They are fragile. They don't want to hear it. That's the problem we have to confront. Relationships haven't been damaged. They've never been built. They've never existed. It's the black-white dichotomy. That's real. That's always been real.
So change step one. What is required step?
So we got first step. Minister talks all the time about, Reverend Davis is saying tables. The minister says we need one table. I believe we have it. I think the real table is it. That is the table that everybody should come to. That table is having real dialogue about racism as it exists in its individual, institutional, and structural forms in the city school district and asking the question, what collectively must we do? That is the starting point. We have the table. People got to come to the table. That's step one.
Where can they come join you?
They can come tonight.
Tonight.
They come tonight at 6 o'clock for one of the subcommittee meetings at Central Office, 131 mm-hmm. West Broad Street. And then the broader meeting is later. Anybody who wants more information, just contact us at howard.eagle90@gmail.com. And I will make sure you get all the information.
And Howard, I just want to say this real quick. It has bearing on what we're talking about now. We're bringing this distinguished educator in.
Oh, yes.
Who's going to complicate the conversation we're having,
yes.
Because that's resources, $200,000-$300,000 that we don't have. That's services that could be going to our children. And so here we are again having a very critical conversation, but you ask, what are some of the solutions? Here's one that is not a solution, because this is resources that are not going to the classroom, not going to the families, not going to the students, and our board and superintendent are dissing the community, having no conversation with the parents, the students, nor the stakeholders, the taxpayers. But yet, the state demands that we foot the bill and we have no decision-making power on the money.
That's part of the racism. They would never, Ilya would never do what she's done in terms of a so-called distinguished educator in Pittsburgh or Fairport or around the corner of Penfield or any suburban district. They would never bring somebody into that community without having a discussion with the parents. That's part of the institutional racism. They know they can get away with that in urban districts. And you got, people talk about this. People say, well, most of the board members are people of color. Well, so who's really responsible? But that's an important question, right? Because you got people of color rubber stamping that kind of stuff. You got the board president and others rubber stamping. By the way, you all haven't said much about this new guy, about Aquino and his salary and so forth. If the last guy was going to command $200,000 and he has less credentials than the one that they're proposing to bring now, what is this guy getting paid? We don't even know. But we've sent a letter to the commissioner saying this is offensive, this is insulting, you need to rescind the appointment and come to town and have a discussion with us about developing a plan.
Dr. Willis, we're about to run out of time here. Any response on Dr. Aquino? Any concerns there from the district standpoint?
So, I mean, outside of my umbrella, I mean, obviously, Dr. Aquino's not here. He's on his way here. Some of that information might be information that's coming along the way. I don't have to.
Also, as we close the program, you know, when you talk about how hard change is, Oklahoma was looking in 2015 at new APUS history standards, and some lawmakers said that they would protest this because it didn't teach American exceptionalism enough. So there's going to be tough conversations to be had, and I hope that we can continue to do that.
We're gonna have it.
With all of them, with everyone involved here. Our thanks to Dr. Jason Willis from the City School District. Dr. Willis, thank you. We'll
appreciate
see you again.
You. Thank
Our
you.
Thanks to Howard Eagle, Minister Clifford Florence, Reverend Davis, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
More connections coming up.